Alrighty, welcome back to another episode of the Look Up Podcast. I'm joined with special guest Larry Lufkin, who's currently in Olympia, correct?
Yes.
Olympia, Washington. And Larry Lufkin is son of Francis Lufkin, who, if you guys tuned in my previous podcast with Bill Moody, he's the godfather of smoke jumping, essentially. And as I found out recently, the first Forest Service smoke jumper to ever jump out of a plane via Larry here. And Larry also was a smoke jumper and jumped out of Cave Junction. Is that right, Larry?
Yes, my brother and I both.
Well, both you and your brother. And then you're in the 101st. And then did you go from the smoke jumping world to the 101st and serving in Vietnam and then back to smoke jumping? Or what was the order there, I guess?
Yeah, I jumped from 63 to 67 in Cave Junction. And at the end of the summer, I was drafted and went in the Army and had basic up at Fort Lewis. And during the basic training, they trooped all of my whole company over to a big barn-like building, and we were all sitting in these bleachers, and this sergeant, all duded out in his airborne stuff, was strutting up and down talking about how great the airborne training was and how we would really like it. And he says, on top of that, he says, they pay you $55 a month to jump out of an airplane. And I said, that's for me, because I just got my first paycheck of $78. So that almost doubled my paycheck.
Yeah, big deal.
What I didn't realize, that meant automatic infantry training. And So I went to Fort Polk and went through infantry training, then to Fort Benning for jump school, and then right straight to Vietnam. But as it turned out, I went on one patrol, and they reassigned 102 guys in my group. 100 of them went right straight to line units, and me and one other guy were assigned to the 101st Airborne Admin Company. And they made a computer data entry guy out of me.
Oh, nice.
But I had 4 years of college and computers, and I think that's why, one of the reasons, but it was kind of interesting in that the reason I got selected for admin company was because the guy who was cutting the orders was from Tacoma.
Oh.
Another guy who worked in the machines branch, they called it then, now you'd call it a computer center, was from Seattle. His name was Tom Lufkin. And he thought the two of us, being from Washington, were probably related. Of course, we weren't. But he went running over there and asking Tom if he knew me. And, of course, Tom didn't know me from Adams off Fox. And so while they were talking and they had my records there, the CO of that unit came walking up and heard him talking. And he says, let me see his records. And he took a look at him. Oh, I said, hey, I'll send him over here. I can use another guy. So that's how I ended up in the computer center.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So
yeah, how was it? Yeah, what was that entailing, I guess, back then? You know, because computers are probably a bit bigger and a little bit slower, I imagine.
Well, our computer was a UNIVAC, if you've ever heard of it.
No, that's the first time I'm ever hearing of it.
Okay, it was a UNIVAC. Actually, computers then were really just glorified card readers. And so all of our data entry was done on IBM cards. Have you seen an IBM card? It's a piece of cardboard about 8 or 9 inches long and 3 inches high.
Oh.
And what they do is we would write on the card, and then they would we would send it out to a key punch machine, and a key puncher would literally, it's kind of, it looks like a big typewriter, except that instead of typing letters, it punches holes in the card.
Oh.
So like if your name is Luke, you would hit the L button and it'll go kaplunk. And it would put a punch in the number 2 line and a number 8 line for the L. And it would put punch in the number 3 line and a number 9 line for the U. If you understand what it's kind of computer. It's converting to computer language.
And then
then we would take literally thousands of these cards. I mean, like you're talking 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 of them, stacks of them. And we take them out and they would sort them. And they had a big hopper on this IBM, or not IBM, the UNIVAC, and then they would punch a button and it would feed those cards in one at a time.
Oh, wow.
And then it would do whatever it was going to do with the programming inside of it. Nothing was really stored. There was no storage on them other than the what they call random access memory, which was very, very small in those days. And then once they were done with it, then they would print it all back out and give it to us. And we'd get literally stacks of paper feet high. I mean, we're talking 10 feet high stacks of paper. And they would print off multiple copies, so we'd have to take and separate the copy from the carbon paper. So, I mean, you can see where we're going with this, right?
Yeah.
And so it was a lot different in those days, I will tell you, yeah.
Yeah, I bet. Holy cow.
Yeah.
And was a lot of it just like input from soldiers serving, or just every kind of information you could think of from the military?
Actually, the unit I was assigned to was called the Admin Machines Branch. And our job was to maintain the database on the entire body of, or the entire group of soldiers in the 101st Airborne, around, I don't know, 20, 30,000 guys or something like that. So it wasn't a small job, but we knew their name, their address, their Social Security number, their in those days, the service number they had too, their specialties and their rank and all a whole bunch of stuff like that. That was all in that one record.
Oh, man.
And so it was, we were supposed to have a security clearance. I never had one. You know, they just needed somebody to fill the slot, and that was it.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Kind of probably desperate for some manpower back in those days, huh, when so many people are getting enlisted and everything?
Oh, absolutely. 68 and 69, if you remember, that was the year that the North Vietnamese put on the big Tet offensives.
Oh.
And it was not safe to be in Vietnam. They killed more guys in those 2 years than any other 2 years combined. And, something like close to a third of the guys killed were killed during those 2 years.
Jeez. Yeah. I probably knew that, you know, a bit of a history buff, but like it wasn't ringing a bell, but holy cow. I mean, that had to be one crazy 2 years, you know, violent and. Whew.
Yeah. My old base was at a place called Ben Hoa, which is just north of Saigon. And that's where they mixed. You ever heard the term Agent Orange?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, Agent Orange is actually just a mixture of plant poisons. And that's where they mixed it and loaded it onto C-123s and flew it out and dumped it on the jungles. And my old base now is considered a toxic waste dump.
Really?
And, I still have the effects of it. I've had cancer and skin problems and all kinds of stuff from it, yeah.
I was going to ask you because I want to say here in Missoula, they're mixing it up, but I want to say one of the fellows from the Forest Service, his father was involved in that, in the, you know, whatever the mixing part was or the chemical process. And mm-hmm. Yeah, he was pretty healthy his whole life. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he got a very, very aggressive cancer and took him out pretty quick. And that wasn't that long ago, you know, and he was doing all the treatments and stuff. And so yeah, whatever's in that stuff is real bad news.
Yeah. It's amazing. I'm on a couple of Facebook pages with Vietnam vets, and it's amazing how we all have a lot of the same stuff, skin ailments like rashes and stuff, and we use the same medications for it. So it, you can tell we were all over there at the same time.
But, yeah.
But and, yeah, I'm lucky though. I'm almost 80. I know a lot of guys that died in their 50s.
Yeah. Man, well, because back in the day, they're telling you it wasn't bad, right? So there's some soldiers in the jungle that are just kind of probably walking through it, right? And
well, actually, they didn't even make an issue of Agent Orange until around 1980. Up until then, they didn't care.
Man.
Yeah.
That's a bad deal.
Yep.
So how are you in the 101st then? Well, I guess a quick question. What aircraft did you train on? Did you jump out of?
Okay, catch this one. I made my five airborne jumps out of a C-119. Which is a Korean War era of plane, yes. A big tail job. Yeah, it looks like a big bumblebee going through the air.
Really?
And virtually every guy that jumped out of it said they hated it, including me, because of their rattle traps.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. The plane vibrated so much that it would make your feet feel funny. And so when we'd take off, the engine would be wound up, we'd lift our feet up in the air to keep our feet from picking up that vibration off the floor.
Oh, put your feet to sleep probably after a while too, huh?
Yeah, you know, because we just didn't take off, run over and jump. It was also an Air Force training flight. So when we took off, they would fly these vectors for like an hour before they came over to the jump field.
Jeez.
And so we'd be sitting there that whole time. And then finally, they'd tell us to stand up in the whole theater. And we would line up and out the back door we'd go. They had actually two back doors, one on each side of the clamshell.
Really? Uh-huh. So would they stick to one side or would you go out either side?
Both sides. Yeah,
both sides.
Each side.
Wow.
You did the airborne shuffle up each side, and then we would out the door you went. Yep.
Oh wow! So just like both sides, just pouring out, kind of.
Yep.
Wow.
It'd be just when you opened up, all you could see in front of you was just solid parachutes.
That had to be a sight. I've seen videos of that even like recent days. You know, they're going on the back of like a C-130 now, I think, right? So it's
right.
Probably easier, but. Man, that's a sight to see, huh? And I can imagine under canopy, it's got to be a real sight to see.
It is. Although the T-10 canopies, which actually I had jumped a T-10 canopy with the Forest Service, believe it or not.
Oh, really?
In 66 or 67, they tested them out. So I had seen it before and knew what it was. The only difference was, the Army T-10s didn't have any guidance on them, where our T-10s had been cut with slots so that you could guide them. And it was something to see, all those brown chutes, you know, literally for a mile.
And they tell you in the military to just pull on the riser, right, to try to collapse a little bit to get some turn out of it?
That's the only thing you could do was slip them.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
And, yeah,
I actually tried that one time, trying to get closer to the truck, but it's like pushing an elephant around.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the only reason why I know a little bit about that is because, NCSB, they had us do the training on it, you know, which, you know, they probably don't do as much anymore because of squares, but, you know, they dropped us off at like 10,000 feet above Winthrop there, and then we got to play around, try to, you know, like you said, slip turn, and it just was not happening.
Exactly. It's a lost cause. I mean, it sounds good. And if you watch an old World War II training film, they show them slipping and stuff. I'm here to tell you, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I've tried it.
Yeah. And I was getting it all I had, you know, I was probably somewhere closer to 200 pounds at the time. And I was climbing up that riser and I was really pulling and I wasn't getting any action out of it.
Yep. So,
the only thing I was worried about was like then fully collapsing my chute and then getting a little faster ride to the ground than I would like. So I gave up pretty quick.
Yeah, I hear you. But
So the T-10 the Forest Service adopted for a second, it had the gores cut in it, like you said, with the toggle for turning. And
yeah, it was more like a seal cut, if you ever heard that term.
No.
We tried they tried a number of things to try to speed up the forward speed and turn the capability of the 5A first.
Yeah.
And so we were using different stuff, and one of them I don't remember exactly, but instead of having big slots like the original 5A had, they had actually cut out parts of the canopy, and then when you pull the guidelines, that would change that direction of those openings and hopefully speed it up a little bit as far as the turn. It did a little bit, but it really wasn't anything to squawk about. I don't think until later on they came out with that blue 30-footer. I think it was a lot better than the old 5As.
Oh, gotcha. Because on the newer ones, up until they, you know, moved over to the Rams, it was like a closed system, right? And then when you pull on one of the toggles, it opened it up, I think.
Yes.
Is how it worked, right?
So yeah. Kind of, yeah. They had different ways of doing it. The real dog of the bunch was the old FS2, the candy stripe chute. And that wasn't much better than a cargo chute.
Really?
Oh yeah, they were bad. Yeah.
Just coming in hot every time, just super fast.
Well, they only came down faster, but the steering and the forward speed was lousy. I mean, it was worse than the 5A even.
Oh, and, man. So if you were just misspotted by a hair, you probably weren't going to be able to make it to the spot then, huh?
Exactly, yeah. You just almost had to be lucky, yeah. Jeez. And I jumped those a few times. My dad, who ran NCSB, was not one for throwing stuff away. And he continued to use the FS-228 Scandi Stripe chutes for, I don't know, a couple of more, two or three more years after Jim Allen at Cave Junction and got rid of them. And what happened was, and I remember my brother saying the same thing, is that in order to jump a 28, you had to be less than 170 pounds or something like that, which I was at the time. And so they saved the big 5A's or the bigger 5A's for the heavier guys. And if you were a young, a smaller guy, you got a 28. That, frankly, my first 28 jump, I didn't even know I had it until I jumped it and I looked up and saw Candy Stripes.
Yeah, I was wondering.
That's when I said, well, okay, let's see where we go. So.
Yeah. Man, what a beautiful looking shoot, but holy cow, it's got to be tough not having that performance, you know?
Yeah. Yep. But, Jim Allen, he kept a couple of old Eagle shoots at Cave Junction. And because he had jumped those back in 46 when he started. And, of course, that was the shoot that my dad jumped in 39 and then in the early 40s.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I want to tell you, that was a shoot I did never want to jump.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Jim would pack up one of those every year for a show jump, or not a show jump, but we actually used a decoy we called Oscars made out of heavy pipes to simulate a jumper. And they would take it up at about 500 feet and just throw it out. And I mean to tell you, when that chute opened, you could hear it go crack. That's how fast it opened.
Oh, man.
There were stories of guys that would black out from it and get back injuries and that sort of thing.
Jeez. And that would open opposite of the ones that I jumped, right? So you get canopy first and then the lines would splay out, right? Like, and kind of throw the jumper.
Yep.
Like, pretty hard.
Right. That actually started my rookie year in 63. They went to the what they called the deployment bag, and D-bag, we called them.
Yeah.
And what happened was they would stow the lines on the backboard, and then the chute would feed into this bag, and you would stuff the chute into this bag and tie the end of the bag closed with a brake cord, they called it. So that when you jumped out, the static line would first take all the lines and stretch them out, and then once the lines are stretched out and a static line was stretched out, it would break that brake cord and the chute would pop out. So you didn't get that chute opening first and then drop like a rock on a string.
Yeah, that opening shock, right? So yeah, for folks listening or watching, I guess, because listening, you probably won't understand, but yeah, like, so what Larry's saying is if you would splay out, jumper's my left hand here, you'd splay out, and then the chute would open, and you just kind of right yourself. It was pretty gentle. I mean, I had really gentle openings, but the opposite way was the old way, like you said, in those Eagles, here, and then jumper, boom, you know, like, and then what, at like 100 miles an hour or something, because of whatever the plane's going, right?
Whenever the plane's going, yeah. And, there were, back before my day, it was commonplace for jumpers, whether they were on a practice jump, fire jump, they'd come in with bruises on their shoulders. You talk to some of the really old guys, they got all kinds of stories about being how they got bruised up from those things.
Man,
so, yeah, those cape balls sat right there on your collarbone.
Oh,
and
yeah.
When they would snap, when that thing would hit, that's what caused the bruise.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, you said it like that. I mean, it's not quite as big as my fist. I don't have anything like to show people, but it's bigger than that, and it's just solid metal just sitting there, you know?
Yep.
Oh, man.
So anyway.
They were tougher. I think I was telling Bill Moody that at the, I'll say the 75th anniversary for smoke jumping was a few years back at Missoula. Mm-hmm. Is that right, Larry?
Yes.
Big event there. Yeah. And I met a few folks. Did you come down for that?
I was not able to make that one. No.
Yeah, I just caught the tail end of it because I think I was coming back from AK. And so I just happened to be walking in and just, you know, like seeing some of the older jumpers from back in like those days. And they come in, they're like poking our suits, you know, because our suits are like so marshmallowy now with all the padding. And they're like, We didn't need that much padding in my day, and like kind of talk a little trash. And it was funny though. It was, you know, it was all fun, but it was really great to interact with those guys and basically make us, you know, call us wusses the whole time. So it was funny.
Well, they needed them. They just wouldn't admit it. But But you know, it's funny you mentioned Bill Moody. I just got an email today from him. And he had been conversing with a lady over at White Boot Company in Spokane.
Oh, yeah.
And she told Bill that my dad wore the very first pair of white smoke jumper boots. And I, of course, never heard that. You know, my dad always wore whites. And when I jumped, that's what I wore, was whites. I mean, that's what everybody wore.
Yeah.
For the most part. A few guys didn't. But anyway, but the follow-on to that is I have my dad's last pair of whites in my garage.
Really?
The last pair that he bought was around 1970 before he retired.
And, man.
I'm going to get hold of White Boots, and if they want them, I'll just send them up there. This is what they used to look like. Probably.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, I bet. You know, like, you don't change something that works, right? You know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And,
right.
Yeah.
I always liked mine. They were tough boots, you know.
Yeah. Well, and that's why they're so nice, too, is because they last forever, and you can just get them resold if they get, you know, slicked off a little bit after a few seasons, you know, like, you know, typically like three or four, and get some new soles on them and keep going.
Exactly. I mean, what would wear them out is the heat from the fire and the rocks, sharp rocks, would literally wear the bottoms right off of them.
Yeah, totally. Like, and that kind of goes to another more recent argument when, you know, some of the bases, you know, like Reading always requires us to be boots and greens whenever we're boosting there. And, you know, our argument back was like, oh, man, you know, why can't we just be in like our, you know, PT shoes until we're actually on the first load? Because, you know, less wear and tear in our boots. Yeah, that's what we're saying.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because in Cave Junction, we were able to do that at times. If you were down on the jump list, it was okay if you wore a pair of, you know, just hiking boots and around the base, because it was a lot easier on your feet. Well, that was okay until they got a multi-man fire request, which happened to me one time, and I can remember flying along and saying to myself, I'm in trouble here because I don't have a heel to hold that strap under my boot, and I was afraid what's going to happen if that strap slips off. I'm going to be in a lot of pain in a hurry. Luckily, it didn't, but I can remember thinking about it, and that was the last time I wore flat-bottom boots.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, like my the boots I rookied in were some like more hiker style with a little heel lowest. And yeah, I wasn't thinking, cause I didn't know how a jumpsuit, worked, you know? So when I was trying my on, they were kind of like looking at my heel in NCSB there. And I was like, you know, kind of looking at them and they're like, it should work. I'm like, but they didn't tell me. And I was like, should work, you know? And then later on I found out that's exactly what they were doing, was seeing if that strap would hold. And, and that was in my head for the rest of the season. Then after I made the rookie training, I was like, you know, I'd always be double checking my boots before I went out the door, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. You start worrying about things you probably shouldn't have to.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It probably would have been fine. You know, it was fine. I never had an issue with it, but it always made me second guess it, you know, and make sure I had that strap real tight, you know, on the bottom there.
Yeah.
And speaking of jumpsuits, how cool is it that your dad's suit is on display there in Missoula?
I was very, very happy that you were able to send me that picture, and because that suit kind of got lost, as I explained to you. Initially, we thought that it would be a great place, the Evergreen Museum, Aviation Museum in Minnville, but then they ran into financial problems, and that's when after a year or so, I called the guy, and I said, look, I'd like to get that suit back, and he wouldn't give it back. Yeah. And I didn't know what we were going to do, but I didn't want it to just disappear because it's one of a kind. And so that's when Kim Maynard from Missoula called me and asked me about it. And working through her, and I believe her husband and a friend, they were the ones that went down and convinced them, say, hey, we'll take it up to Missoula, put it in a museum up here. And they said, fine, do it. That's how it got up there. Yeah.
So glad. Yeah. And really? I think, you know, folks watching this or listening, you know, you can look it up, you know, Francis Lufkin. You'll probably just Google your dad. I imagine a lot of those photos will come up, right, with your dad in the suit, I think.
Yep. That, yeah, because what actually, the pictures that you've seen with the red suit and everything, like the one on the display, the original picture was actually in black and white. Oh. And what I did, I knew that it had color to it, but I didn't know how to do it. Well, I was talking to my mother one day, and she's the one who says, well, I can tell you what the colors were, because she'd seen everything.
Yeah.
My dad was literally colorblind. He couldn't see colors at all. Made a great deer hunter, but a lousy color guy.
Yeah.
So I took a picture up there, and she got a little swatch of the different colors, like the green on the plane and the silver on the propeller and the red on the suit and that sort of thing, and just stuck them on the picture that I had. I took that picture downtown to a photographer down here in Olympia, and one of his people that he knew was an artist, and she's the one that colorized that picture with the colors.
Oh, that's very cool.
Right. And he gave me the digital version as well as an original, which I have in my desk here. But
the
photo is actually a U.S. Forest Service photo. So it's free to whoever wants to do it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so folks listening or watching, like, yeah, check out that photo and that the red suit your dad's. I mean, all the colors are very vibrant. You know, the Stinson plane, you know, behind your father, which, you know, you told me, I didn't know it was Stinson. And the green on that is beautiful, and the red is just so vibrant. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that's why when you mentioned that the museum, I guess it's a museum that's restoring that same plane?
Yeah, yeah. So, and I'm trying to think how he got a hold of it, but I think it's his dad is the one who really running the Museum of Mountain Flying, and they're the ones who tracked down Miss Montana, who was, you know, the same jump plane that the Man Gulch folks jumped out of, and that it went to Africa, and then they found it, I think, somewhere in like Oklahoma or something. And the same thing with that Stinson, I think they found it somewhere in like Arkansas or somewhere, and I don't know exactly how it tracked it, but the cool thing is that you color matching the photo is giving this fella, and I don't think he knows it because I didn't know it until, you know, just now, I think, that you're giving the right colors, because he wants to color match it so it looks exactly like the day your dad stepped out of it.
Well, he's got the picture right there in front of him.
Yep.
I assume that's where they're doing the work anyways, right there at the museum or someplace around there.
Yeah, I believe so. So, yeah, it's cool because, like, you can see the red your dad jumps at, that beautiful green behind it. And without you color matching that photo, you know, that fellow wouldn't have the opportunity to match the – I mean, he'd probably be close, but not as accurate as you know, he will be now with, you know, the work you did, which is – it's cool how things come full circle like that.
Right. Yeah, because back in those days, the Forest Service green was a dark green. The current Forest Service green is a light green, and it's been that way for, since the late 50s, early 60s, when they switched to colors. And so, like, if old-time photos of Forest Service vehicles, they were always a dark green. And so that's why that plane probably was painted that dark green. Because that was the Forest Service owned that plane.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. I'll have to pick that guy's brain. You know, we're kind of in a rush, but I'm gonna have to go back and ask him more of the story about the plane, because, you know, obviously running a museum, he's a history buff himself, so I'd like to know its story, you know.
Yep. Yeah, it is. I actually have some information on my computer here. Somebody sent me a bunch of information years ago, and I've just never deleted it. Maybe if I'll dig around, and if I can, I'll forward it to you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It had some of the history and numbers and stuff of that plane. I can't remember it all, but why he sent it to me, I just don't remember now. But I think it was because of the one of the original demonstrations that were set up. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, it's kind of strange how even like some of the public, when they find something that is Forest Service related, they like to kind of track down its story and then probably in turn find you. And the example I have is when I was in Miles City, boosting you know, the spike base there, Miles City, Montana, the stairs are I'm trying to remember the somewhere in the southwest, I'm trying to remember it, and it ends up spelling ass. something smoke jumpers at the end, so it's like ASS. Man. I can't remember exactly what forest it is, but it, you know, ends up spelling ass, so it's kind of funny, but it's a, you know, it's kind of historic because Don Mackey painted a mural on it, and then he signed it, and a bunch of the fellows, you know, who died in South Canyon. But the story behind that is someone was on fire, I think, in the Southwest, and they got a random phone call from somebody who knew somebody, and they're like, hey, this guy's at this gas station, and he knows you're in the area, and he's got these stairs that belong to you. And the guy thought, like, personally, and then he picks him up, and he has no idea that these stairs are, you know, old smoke trooper stairs from the plane, and they're in great shape, you know, so me and another buddy kind of help fix them up and reinforce them with just some extra wood on the inside, but the outside's still the same. It's like, yeah. it's just pretty cool as things happen, you know?
Yeah, the talking about stairs on a plane, some of the original planes had steps on them and others did not. And I remember my first time jumping out of a beach that did not have steps on it. You had to sit down in a door and your legs would be flopping in the wind. And the way you jumped, and you didn't actually jump, you would put your hands down and do kind of a kip up and just fall out the front, out the side of the
door. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was the Ford Trimotor kind of the same? Because the photos I've seen of it, it kind of looks like guys are just dangling out there too, you know?
I believe it's probably the exact same, yeah. Actually, the Ford Trimotor video that Bill Moody and the other guys filmed, I was actually in McMinnville when they filmed that and was down on the ground watching it. And the door is on the wrong side of the plane, and, you know, because normally the plane, the door is on the same side as the pilot, left side.
Yeah.
In the Ford, it's on the right side. So there's a little bit of differences with those things, yeah.
Which is kind of tricky because, like you said, the way our patterns work is as the smoke jumper, you know, like the plane tips so the pilot can see the jump spot along with the spotter and the jumper, you know.
Yeah, and the streamers and all that, you bet.
Yeah,
those pilots get awfully good at knowing how to track that airplane right over the spot.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. The NCSB pilot, I think he's retired now. He had been in there forever, and holy cow, was he good.
Yeah.
And to be able to maintain that altitude for, you know, folks listening, like, you know, they're maintaining an altitude as they're flying around while looking outside the plane, you know, and glancing at their instruments, I imagine, more or less, and still keep an eye on the jump spot and maintain that nice circle. It's impressive.
It is. They have to be darn good. You're right.
Yeah.
So did you say you
smoke jumped 2 years before you went to the military then?
It was the end of my fourth year is when I got drafted. I got drafted in October, and I was in the military then from October of 67 until May of 69. Actually, I was only in 19 months and 2 days. And most of that was in Vietnam. But the rule in back in those days was if you came back from Vietnam with less than 5 months of active duty to serve, they just kick you out on the spot, ETS they call it. So that I came back with 2 days over the minimum, and they gave me my DD-214 and I went home.
Oh, nice.
But anyway, I got home in time to get married, go on a honeymoon, and then right straight to Cave Junction for another year of jumping in 69. So I only missed 1 year of jumping, yeah, smoke jumping.
Wow. Wow, that's awesome, Larry. I had no idea. Man, that's busy. That's a busy couple of years, though, huh?
Yeah, and I was lucky. I was on the first demonstration group that went to Wise, Virginia for that. They tested jumping back there for several years. They finally gave it. I think they just ran out of money, if I remember correctly. There was an article written about it in the Smoke Jumper magazine years ago, I know.
I also looked that up because I was very curious about that because I remember when I first got into jumping, I was like, you know, I knew we were sending folks to the to Region 8 and to burn stuff. I was like, I'm surprised, you know, they have a lot of fires here and they have mountains. I wonder why there isn't a jump base. And then someone who knew a little bit told me there used to be, and he said it's Virginia, huh?
Wise, Virginia, yes. Mm-hmm. It's a little town up in the mountains. It's a hillbilly town, at least it was then. Actually, the airport was built on the top of a mountain. And what had happened was, of course, when they coal mined back there, at least in those days, they would just strip off the top of the ground, take the coal out, and then leave. Well, that's what they had done to this mountaintop. They'd taken the top of the mountain off. I don't know where it went. And then they took the coal off, and that left enough room to build, put a runway on.
That is nuts.
So they the runway was on top of, well, of course, it was way down lower than it had been, but that's where the runway was. Yeah.
I wonder if, yeah, I'll have to look that up. I wonder if it's still like that.
I would guess so. It's not useful for much else, not that I know of.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I heard another reason why they stopped it. You know, probably budget was probably the real reason, but they said that they started seeing what do they call them? Really symmetrical fires, because a lot of the folks out there were bored, you know, and they would light a tire. They go to the top of the hill, light a tire, and then they'd see like a. So all these fires that kept jumping were like a line of fire had been rolled down the hill. So they're like, maybe we got to stop doing this, and so we'll stop lighting the fires. that was one of the things I heard.
Well, you funny should mention that, because virtually every fire we jumped that summer, that spring of 71, was man-caused. And you mentioned a line of fire. One of the fires that I jumped with a big group was when we hit the ground, I found the start of the fire, and then I could see where it had gone right up through the set of woods in kind of an arc. Well, what it turned out was some guy was mad at the government, you know, the IRS or who God knows what. And so what he had done is he had set a whole string of explosives, and he'd tie them to a tree, walk a little ways, tie them to a tree, walk a little ways. But he set them off so that it started on the far end and then came back. And so as they blew, of course, it blew a tree down and started a fire. And so that was one of the fires. Another fire, these guys were busy digging fire line, and here came these two guys running by carrying a still. Their still had caught on fire and started the fire.
Save the still?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Man, that was so cool. Bill, you're the only person, Larry, you're the only person I've ever met that I know of that jumped out of the East. That was really cool.
Yeah, most of the guys who were back there are no longer with us, but there's a couple of us left. But
so, how did that work then, Larry? Did they just take like whatever base wasn't using a plane and kind of fare everything out that way, and the jumpers would drive the plane, or did you guys drive, or?
Well, no, they flew us all back there. The first four guys that went, I was actually the second group that went. The first four guys, they stuck them in a Cave Junction plane and flew them back. Our pilot and D. Dutton, who was the Cave Junction manager at the time, he was the official spotter. And those six guys flew to Wise, Virginia, and they started having fires. So they ordered some more, and they ordered two from each base, if I remember. Two from Redmond, two from North Cascades, and two from Cave Junction. And we all, we went to Medford and flew to Portland and all the way back to Bristol, Tennessee. That's where they picked us up and drove us over to Wise.
And was that like commercial then you guys flew?
Yes, we flew commercial back there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gotcha. But the first guys went with the jump plane then, you said, right?
Yeah, the first guys, so the plane was already there when we got there.
And, oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man. But, and where'd you get, did they have like bunk houses, or did you guys just have to hotel up, or?
We stayed in motels. And being in a hillbilly town was different. I remember one night, it was a Saturday night, and we knew we had to get up early because they were talking about fires the next day. And lo and behold, some guy brings his girlfriend, and they're shacked up in the room right next to us, and they're going at it. I mean, they're having a great time in there, drinking and doing all kinds of wild stuff.
Yeah.
And I pounded on the wall and told him to shut up, and he just started laughing. So I got up, put my boots on, and walked out the door over to his door, and I started kicking on the door. That door was just literally bending in. And I told him if he made one more peep out of him, I was going to drag him out of there and beat the hell out of him. And, boy, the rest of the night, not a peep out of them. So.
Oh, that is awesome.
But,
yeah, those walls probably paper thin back then, eh?
Oh, yeah. And you couldn't keep anything. If you didn't lock it up, you didn't have it. So, when we had gas for our chainsaws and stuff, somebody thought, oh, it'd be real. We didn't want to put it in the building where all of our chutes and stuff were, because if it caught on fire, we'd lose everything.
Yeah.
So, no problem. There's a big culvert just outside the building. So they took all these cans of gas and stuck them in this culvert. And the next day they went out to get the gas cans, and they were all empty. the locals stole all the gas.
Oh, it lifted it off. Oh, man. Well, that sounds like it's still kind of similar out there in the Appalachian world. I went to the Cherokee Hotshot Base in Unicoi, Tennessee, and they got a big old fence around that place to keep people out.
Yep. They just, it's a different lifestyle. I mean, they're nice people, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We got along great with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they just grow up different, you know, like, then, because we were talking about, you know, even, like, one of the things I've been doing for work lately is going to find some dump sites, even here in the Bitterroot, and it's like, some of the stuff they dump in the woods, like, man, you could have took it to the recycling place and actually got money for it instead of just wasting your gas and driving out in the middle of nowhere to dump it off, you know, like, there's this little camper, and the recycling place will pay you for all the metal and stuff, and then you'll actually get some money back on the deal, you know, but it's just what they're used to. They've always done it, you know, so they're going to keep going and dumping, you know?
Yeah, I remember one fire I jumped on, and we had some cargo that the wind caught it and blew it like a quarter of a mile away over in some farmer's field. And so I was going to walk over there and get it and bring it back, and I saw this guy just running like mad, jumping over fences, and I think, well, that chute's gone, whatever's with it. And pretty soon, here he came, he dragging that whole thing back there. He was just as happy as a clam to help us out.
And oh, really?
Yeah, so we kept the chutes and the I to this day, I don't remember what the cargo was, but whatever it was, he brought it back.
Oh, that's really nice of him. Yeah, he's probably happy just to help out, like you said.
Yep.
Such a cool experience. I was kind of hoping that, you know, like, now there's not much change in the, I don't know, the fire world's so big, I guess, that, you know, there's no reason to open up a jump base back there. But I was always, like, trying to petition to get a spike base opened up back that way, you know?
Yeah, they opened it because they said, well, they in the spring, when all the leaves are dried out, that's when they have their fire season. And then when the leaves come onto the trees, that stops all the fires, and so you don't need them anymore. So that's why that we went back there in April.
And so awesome.
We were there the last part of March, April, and a little bit of May. Before they flew us home, it just died all of a sudden.
Oh, really? Just like a green up deal and
exactly.
Everything. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then how long did you say that was open then? Back that way? Was it?
I think years? It was 71. I think they closed it in like 77 or 78, if I remember correctly. Like I said, if you research it on the NSA magazine, the Smoke Jumper magazine, D. Dutton, who was the originator of that base, and my boss at the time back then wrote an article, quite a detailed article about how that base got set up and how long it went and when it quit and all of that.
Oh, cool. Are there any pictures too? Do you know?
There are not many that I only have one, and that was one that was a newspaper took, and I think I just have a copy of the newspaper photo. It was me and three other guys standing in front of our plane.
But really?
I'm sure other guys had pictures. I don't know of them.
Yeah, I'll have to look up the internet. You know, like Google's pretty impressive. You know, they might have a few photos floating around there. And then I'll also check the NSA website as well and look for that article. Maybe there's a photo attached or something.
Yeah, because the NSA now, it's actually a separate website, but there's a whole photo gallery of smoke jumping pictures. And my guess is, if it's going to be there, that'd be probably the place I'd want to start.
Oh, cool. I'll have to check it.
So if you go to smokejumpers.com and look up the gallery, that's probably where I would recommend you start.
Oh, yeah. I was kind of poking around there the other night. For some reason, it wasn't letting me re-up my membership, so I was going to try after this phone call to get it going. It might have been on my end. We had a bad storm, and our internet got shut down, and the tower seemed to be acting weird. I don't know if you heard about it, but they said... I can't remember what the scale of hurricane. It was like a 2, whatever that means on the hurricane scale. And because it was up on Mount Sentinel behind the University of Montana campus, they recorded, I think, 109 mile an hour wind yesterday, like sustained wind. So,
that's a heavy duty wind.
It was heavy, yeah. They over 100 trees on one of the golf courses, or maybe both the golf courses combined, got uprooted. And you know, a bunch of people had power out, and we had power out until early this morning, and then, you know, it took us a while to get our water back because we're tied in with the neighbors. But yeah, so exciting days in Montana. But I can't remember what I was telling you about the wind, but So what year did you retire then? How long did you smoke jump?
I left smoke jumping in the spring of 71. And I, quite frankly, I had my degree in accounting. It was never my intent to stay smoke jumping that many years. Usually the guys that smoke jump more than 3 or 4 years were all school teachers. That's Bill Moody was that, and John Gordon and Ash Court and a bunch of those guys. They were all school teachers, and so they would teach school in the winter and jump in the summer. So they had a lot more years than most. In my case, at the end of my fourth year of college, I was like 6 hours short of my four-year degree, which meant I had to go back. When I came back from Vietnam, I had to go back to school and get those 6 hours. But by the time I came back, those six had turned into 12, which forced me to take two semesters instead of one. And so I jumped the summer of 70, the 69 and 70. And then in the spring of 71, I got my degree, and I was just kind of sitting around, and the Forest Service I found was just extremely low paid.
Yeah.
And so, I was a GS-7 squad leader, and yet the best they could offer me was a GS-5 business clerk with no advancement. And I was not happy at all. But anyway, what happened was in May of 71, we were taken down to a fire in Northern California, and the wind was just horrendous. And in order to get us far away from the fire so we didn't get blown into the fire, we had to go 2 miles down the canyon.
Oh.
But they insisted we were going to go in there, so we jumped. And one of the guys hit a tree so hard he knocked the top out of the tree and just screwed up his knee. Something fierce broke his leg.
Oh.
And some other guy was wandering around, so we picked him up and we walked the 2 miles into the fire and fought the fire. But anyway, when I got home to Cave Junction, I told my wife, the first outfit that offers me a job, I'm gone. And 3 weeks later, I was gone.
Yeah.
I had a job with the Department of Health and Human Services in there for their inspector general. So.
Oh, nice.
So I had a very good career in accounting and auditing for the feds. I worked 29 years in that era before I finally decided I'd had enough of the federal government and retired for good.
Yeah. I was just talking about that someone recently. I think you just kind of, at least I'm getting towards the end of my career, I think. You know, I got like 17 years in now, you start to feel kind of, I don't know, like a restlessness. You know, it's like, I'm ready to move on, you know?
Well, that's exactly right. I actually took a class years ago from a guy who was a contract course instructor for the feds. And I forget what the class was, but this guy had been a Lutheran minister and a psychologist for a company or a hospital, and then he had gone into private consulting, teaching classes, and his comment was, yeah, a person ought to change jobs every 10 years, and that's what he'd done.
Yeah.
And I always remember that, and I said, that sounds, because it keeps life interesting.
It does, yeah, and that kind of makes sense, I got forced out of jumping for health reasons, but also I was kind of ready for a new challenge, So spring of 18 was my last season as a smoke jumper. So not really even a season, just like last, spring as a smoke jumper. It was kind of refreshing to try something else. I'd done it for five seasons or 5 years at that point, and been in the wildland fire scene for like 15 years, I guess, at that point, So,
exactly. And you probably jumped with Bob Rosenthal up at North Cascades.
Yes,
and
sir.
He's now a dentist. He owns his own dentist shop in Twist,
Yeah. So, and Larry, I've been having this conversation with a lot of folks lately, and probably because of the podcast, but I'm the union, because we're really good at downplaying ourselves as wildland firefighters, but we don't look as clean cut, especially the pictures that, so he's like beards and, soot and dirty pants and dirty yellows and versus you see the structure fire folks, cause that's always what we're compared to, and it's more clean cut, So I think sometimes they think we're undereducated, and it's like, wow, some of the biggest brains I've ever met in my life were on the fire line, especially like Rosenthal,
Yes, exactly. And I know my dad used to keep track of a lot of the old jumpers. I think I mentioned before the one guy who was a 747 pilot would, whenever he flew over that area, he would call down and talk to dad on the radio, and they'd chit chat for a couple of minutes till he got out of range. And my dad had a tremendous memory for jumpers and their names. Oh yeah, he was the guy that did X or whatever, you know.
What a compliment too, you know, the fella, you know, he's still had that soft spot, you know, like in his heart for the, you know, the jump base, and still, you know, would radio in every chance he had as he's coming over. And I mean, that is very cool.
Well, it is. And what most jumpers never knew about my dad was that he had a very traumatic upbringing. My granddad, I never met my granddad. My granddad was an alcoholic, and after my dad was born, it was from what I heard from my other relatives, it was hell on earth with my granddad, and he was known to have violent fits of temper. I mean, some of the stories my dad told, he'd tell them as funny stories, but in reality, they weren't quite so funny if you thought about them. And I can relate one or two if you wanted them, but anyway. When my dad was 15, his dad said, okay, you're old enough to take care of yourself, and kicked him out of the house. And he did that with my dad's other three brothers later on, but my dad was the first. And so my dad was born in Auburn, Washington, just south of Seattle. And so what happened was my grandmother, Grace, had a brother who lived over in... or a cousin, I guess, lived in Winthrop and worked for the Forest Service at the 8 Mile Ranger Station. And she worked out a deal to get my dad over there and to stay I called him Uncle. His name was Uncle Ed. And that's how Dad ended up in the Menhow Valley. And so Dad would work on ranches or a lot of times just for the Forest Service until he turned 16 or 17. And then he went to work for the Forest Service full time. And that's how he ended up being involved in the jumping program. But the other side, the end of that story with my granddad was when my dad was about 20, he went home for a visit. And about the time that he got over there, he found out that my granddad had taken my grandmother's pet bulldog down to a local tavern and traded it for a jug of whiskey. And so she was not happy about it. She wanted a bulldog back. So my dad and his three brothers went down to the tavern and said, we want the bulldog back. And the guy says, nope. He says, I paid for it. Well, they informed him if he wanted a tavern left over, he better give the dog back. Well, the Lufkin boys had a reputation, and so he gave the dog back. And when they got back to the house, my dad told his dad, hit the road, and that's the last time anybody saw him, was walking down the road away from the house. Yeah, actually, he's not. He was only about 5'10", and probably weighed 170 pounds, maybe. But he was, I'll tell you what, he was hell on wheels. Nobody messed with Francis Lufkin. And I'm sure he got that from his dad, you know. Because I've had other old-time jumpers tell me stories about, you know, Dad. And in his young years, he was actually a pretty good drinker himself until my mother put a stop to it. And she'd had enough of that drinking, and he wanted to stay married, you know, and so he quit drinking. Yeah. Right. But I hear stories from jumpers or read stories about how they screwed up and messed this up and did something bad or caused trouble. And the old man had threatened to fire him and then change his mind. And, those guys need to know that he'd been through all of that before. So he knew what they were going through. He was more interested in the guy making good than he was, you know, showing how powerful he was. So, matter of fact, matter of fact, Jim Allen, my boss, and Jim had worked for Dad for like 8 years, told me one time in later years, he says, if your dad had one fault, was he wouldn't fire anybody. But a lot of guys thought they were fired. Yeah. Right. Yep. Yeah. Well, he had a ferocious reputation, and they were scared of him. But I'll tell you, my brothers and I were scared of him too. The only kid who never got a licking in our family is my sister. And she came close a couple of times, but my dad just didn't have the heart to give my sister a spanking. But us boys did. Yeah. Right. Yeah, he mellowed in his later years, and the guys that saw him later on were, you know, they had not seen the original Francis Lufkin from the 1940s. So yes and no. He was a legend in his own time. I think he knew it, but he didn't play the game. You know, he let other people talk about him he didn't go around bragging or, you know, anything like that. If they wanted to talk about it, he'd talk about it. But he was not one for blowing his own horn at all. And as a matter of fact, one thing that I always noted whenever I visited him up there when I'd be in Winthrop on fire duty, one of the things that I noted, are you still there? I've lost you.